Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Retro Computing Roundtable, the show of vintage computer news and views populated by the rock stars of computer history.
There's one thing I'd like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz?
This is Show 5. I'm your host, David Grillish of ClassicComputing.com. I have a blog and I produce two other podcasts, the Classic Computing Show video podcast and Stan Beat's History of the Personal Computer audiobook podcast. I'm broadcasting from the greater Atlanta area, Johns Creek, Georgia. So let's all belly up around the virtual table and get started.
Okay. Rock stars, huh?
Yeah, you like that?
More like the one-hit wonders of computer history.
Are we also supposed to talk like Keith Richards?
Yeah.
Belly up. It's a little presumptuous to assume we're all fat geeks, isn't it?
I want to begin by saying, we're getting the band back together, man. I would like to welcome the panelists of show... I would like to welcome the panelists of Show 2 back here for Show 5.
Woo!
You guys did so well the first time around that I just had to invite you all back. So
couldn't find anybody else.
Well, actually, Carrington Vanston was originally slated for the show, but he got stuck overnight in the Nashville airport.
Oh.
So he'll be back on next show, the 29th of January.
Luckily, your crazy Canadian quota is still A-okay.
You stole my punchline, because... I had it, so because of that, I had to request an emergency Canadian.
Which is why I'm on a crappy camcorder mic. I'm staying at my parents' place, and it's amazing how much junk you have lying around everywhere when you have all the equipment you need to do a podcast.
Right, so thank you, Derek Warren, for being back on the show. You were slated for the next show, so I appreciate it. I literally called you in the 11th hour, literally, right, last night, or emailed you, that is. But anyway, thanks a lot for being back on the show.
Anytime.
And let me officially introduce you again. Let's see. You are in Vancouver, Canada. You host your podcast, the Mac Folklore Radio Podcast, and you fill in from time to time for John on the Retro Maccast. You haven't done that, though, real recently, have you?
I think the last time was September.
So it's about time.
Well, I tried to jam my...
Sorry, John.
Hey.
I'm just kidding.
I try to jam my way into the show from time to time. I actually just submitted something to celebrate Retro Maccast's fourth anniversary, which I think...
It will be on the end of the podcast, yes.
Okay.
Oh, cool.
It was very wonderful. It was a very nice surprise.
Oh, was that today then? This morning that you did that?
Yes.
Okay.
So if John seems a little tired, it's because he's already been up podcasting for the last 3 hours.
And that takes a lot out. No.
And Derek, so you've moved around a lot recently, and I know I tried to call you this morning to verify the number that I had for you last, and I guess you said I might have woken up your parents.
Ever since I started Mac Folklore Radio, I've moved 4 times, so it's all been a bit of a blur.
But where you are now is probably where you'll stay, you think, or? Well, never mind.
I don't even want to think about it. So, yes.
Okay, well, something new I wanted to start, if no one has any objections to it, is I wanted to ask everyone's age, if that's okay. Is that okay?
Oh, sure.
So, Derek, I think you're kind of the youngest in the group, right?
It's always been that way at work, wherever I go. Yeah. Not for much longer, though, because I just turned 28 in November.
Okay. I guess I thought you were around that old for some reason. And
That's because you haven't seen me. People usually think I'm about 20. At the most.
I've seen your picture in my show notes, and then I watched your video, where you guys were putting your tree together and all
that. Yeah, I love those. I love it when you do those.
Well, the secret to those videos is that we're all moving so fast you can't see me.
Right.
Whole idea. You'll never see me in pictures.
The other sort of canned question I was going to ask everyone, too, is, so what was your first computer?
One of my first computer memories was when I was...
You give a couple, succession of a couple of them, your first computers or whatever.
Yeah, so how long do we have? No. I think when I was 2 or 3, I got out of bed one Saturday morning, and I turned on the family's brand new Apple II. So I don't know what compelled me to spend so much time with the computer when I was little, but that was, first one's always free. I got hooked. And... eventually, there was a Commodore 64 that came visiting on weekends, and my sister and I would play games, and I would desperately try to do all the cool stuff they said you could do with BASIC in the manual, but was never successful, but still interested.
Sprites?
Never got those to work. But I spent a lot of time poking around in sector editors and doing weird things with games. Stuff like that. And then the Mac SE came along when I was, I think, 5.
Okay.
And,
right, so long-time Mac person.
Yeah, yeah. But we've always been a multi-platform family.
Well, thanks a lot for being back on the show.
My pleasure.
So next, let me introduce John Leake. John's from sunny Crestview, Florida, and the Panhandle there. And he is the co-host of the Retro MacCast podcast. And so thanks a lot, John, for being back on. And I know, so you also, of course, record your show Saturday morning. So you had a tight schedule today.
Yeah. All right. So my age is 44.
You're younger than I am. So don't feel bad.
And all right. So my succession of early computers goes Timex Sinclair.
Oh. 1000.
TI-99-4A.
Mm-hmm.
Whoa. And then Apple IIe, and the Apple IIe was my computer that I used for a good 6 or 7 years before moving on to a 2GS and then eventually Macintoshes.
Is that the one maybe you consider like your first real computer?
That's usually what when I tell people my first real computer was an Apple IIe.
Because the other two maybe you only kind of fooled around with and didn't really do a lot.
Yeah. Well, to be perfectly honest, I had more fun with the Timex Sinclair than I did with the TI-99-4A.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you probably had to kind of work at it more, and it was probably a little more magical. It was new. And
oh, gosh, yes, yeah. And the saving stuff to the cassette player, fun stuff.
Yeah.
Well, little thermal printer burning up paper on the stick.
Yeah, with that silver paper, wasn't it? Did you have one of those? So it's like a cash register little printer?
I did not have the printer. I did have the 16K memory expansion module
fall out?
That hung on the back like a tumor.
Yeah.
Did you have to use BlueTech to keep it in place?
I do remember at one point one of the pins broke and I had to fix it with a piece of aluminum can and some super glue. So.
Bad design. All right, so now we move to Evan and Evan Koblenz. And Evan, you are in, I have you down as Weld, New Jersey. That's what we had as the last show, but that's not actually where you live, right?
No, that's where my museum is. I live in Springfield, New Jersey.
Okay. And you are the founder and president of the Mid-Atlantic Retro Computing Hobbyists, or MARCH. And MARCH is the organizer of the Vintage Computer Festival East, which number 7 is coming up this year.
May 14 and 15 at our museum.
Very excited about that. And I have pretty almost 100% certain I'm going this year. And I know we emailed back and forth a couple of times. And hopefully we're going to do I don't know if I would call it I guess it's a live show. I don't know if it's going to broadcast live, if we can make that happen. But we're going to do a retro computing roundcast from the VCF East. So that would be really
wonderful.
Exciting.
Yeah, looking forward to that.
And I spoke to my supervisor at work, and he's very interested. I think he's going to come with me.
So great.
That will make the 12-hour drive a whole lot better because I want to exhibit, and so I have to drive to do that. Anything else new going on with you?
Just busy in a real life.
Yeah. Well, I know you guys are building, you're building out, aren't you, new museum space, that sort
of
thing?
Well, yeah. Right now, our public exhibit space is only 900 square feet. In any museum, only a small fraction is on public exhibit at any time.
Right.
We're currently expanding our public space to 3,000 square feet, so we're going to triple our public space, but we're fighting various bureaucratic delays and whatnot, so these things never happen as fast as we want them to.
Right.
Hopefully this summer, hopefully in time for VCF, or at least a beta version.
So, Evan, where do you fall into the age spectrum?
Well, in binary, I am 100100, in hex, I'm 24. In English, I'm 36.
Okay. So I am indeed the oldest one here. And that's okay.
I started out on, I think the first thing I had computery was in television, Pong.
Yeah.
And then I graduated to a Atari VCS. I think I had the first one before it was called a 2600. And then in school, around third grade, fourth grade, we learned Logo on VIC-20s. And around middle school, fifth, sixth grade, my older brother got an Apple IIe for his bar mitzvah, and he never took to it. He became a lawyer, so it became my computer. Okay. And the Apple IIe is what I really learned on.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for being back on the show.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm 46 years old, and my first computer was I kind of fell in love with the Mac, though, first. So I wasn't going to buy anything until I could get a Macintosh. That was 86. But then a girlfriend very generously gave me a Commodore 64 in later that year, I think. Now I think about it. Yeah, Christmas of 86. So that was kind of my first computer, but all I did was just sort of mess around on it. It's all I had. I didn't have a cassette drive or a display or anything. So my first real computer was an Apple Lisa running MacWorks Plus. And then I had a succession of Macs after that. Mac Classic and a Performa C400, which is an LC2, and then a Performa 6200. I had a couple of those bad, what is it called, a low-end Mac? What do they call them, Rogue Apples?
Rogue Apples.
Yeah, so I had two of those.
You went from the LC2 to the 6200, and you're probably wondering, gee, why isn't this any faster?
I mean, definitely, it was okay for me for what I used it for, and it was certainly faster, but yeah, it wasn't, you know, it kind of became slow within a couple of years pretty quickly. All right. First up, just a quick topic is the Consumer Electronics Show, or CES, which is going on right now. I just wanted to bring it up to see if anyone had anything to relate to it, you know, historically. And so a quick Wikipedia search shows that it started in 1967. You know, they used to have two a year. Now they only have one a year in Las Vegas. So there's a few historic things that were introduced at CES. So I thought it was worth mentioning. And so if you scroll down on the Wikipedia article to notable product introductions, some of the ones that are notable to me, because there's like 15, 20 of them. There's a Virtual Boy in 1995, CDI in 1991, Tetris 1988, the NES system in 85, the Amiga in 84. I'm going in order of how they have it here. Commodore 64 in 82. So I see, Derek, you had said that. So you're 1 year off.
Oh, thanks.
The Compact Disc Player in 1981. That's kind of surprising that it's that long ago that that was introduced to me. But camcorder.
And surprising how quickly it's become irrelevant in the last few years.
And then, you know, Pong was introduced 75, Laserdisc 74, and the VCR in 1970. And there's a
also,
few.
Also, I forget if it was 92 or 93. One of those years they introduced the IBM Simon, which was the first smartphone.
Oh, really? In CES?
I'm almost certain.
Let's do a quick search.
You'd think IBM would have the smarts to stay out of consumer electronics after the PC Junior, but I guess not.
Was shown at COMDEX in 92.
Oh, COMDEX, I'm sorry.
It was also in Las Vegas, but COMDEX doesn't exist anymore, right?
That's right.
Since about 2001, I think.
No, it was more recently than that.
I kind of remember COMDEX being, wasn't it bigger than CES for the longest time, too? Or no?
I don't think it was bigger. I went to every COMDEX from about 98 to about just about to the end. And
it was,
I think,
like more
CES, I was at CES as well. Well, yeah, COMDEX was a trade show. It was Computer Dealers Exchange, COMDEX, whereas CES was always a consumer crowd. But COMDEX was a large, at least in the U.S. I mean, it wasn't as big as CeBIT in Germany or anything, but in the U.S., COMDEX was the, you know, the 800-pound gorilla of computer, you know, IT trade shows.
Next up is I want to bring up the Retro Challenge. And so currently the Retro Challenge 2011 Winter Warm-Up is going on. It started the first of the year, so about a week has gone on. But it's the entire month of January, and I thought it was Dale, is his name, Goodfellow, who's done that 300 Baud newsletter who organizes.
That's
it.
Him.
Is it still him? I just thought there was another name associated. In any case, pretty much, to sum it up, you're always welcome to join in any time during the month. So is anyone participating in that?
I'm not sure that I understand what it is.
There's certain guidelines. They're very broad guidelines, and you can just do pretty much anything you want, hardware, software. So, there's one person that's doing art related to old computers. So
it's kind of like a contest without rules?
Oh, well, like you said, there's guidelines.
Okay.
Yeah, here's the rules and prizes. Scroll about halfway down on that page, and what does it say? Projects may encompass any aspect of retro computing that tickles the fancy of the individual entrant. Winners will be arbitrarily chosen and crap prizes doled out during the first week of February 2011. And then
you can really do anything you want so long as it's, you know, retro computing related. My favorite example from his interview, from Dale's interview on Retro Madcast, is you could keep track of the butterfly population in your backyard on your Commodore 64, for example.
Yeah, Dale Goodfellow. So I thought maybe in a tweet or something I saw a different name associated, but, you know, I'm sure he has helpers. But okay, so check that out. Next, we're going to talk about a it's a PDF document or or book that you can download. You can also buy a hardcover version of this by making a donation to Viewpoints Research. But it's called The Points of View, A Tribute to Alan Kay. And I know I was speaking to you earlier, Evan. So, Evan, you wanted to speak to this.
Yeah. Wow. Alan Kay is one of those guys where I think a lot of hobbyists have heard of him, but I don't know if everyone understands what he's done and what he's really famous for.
I think a lot of Mac people.
Mac people would, yes, but I don't know if everyone within the wider hobby. Alan went to the University of Utah. He worked with the likes of Ivan Sutherland, mm-hmm. Who did the Sketchpad, and he wrote a lot of early documents about the idea, not just for portable computing, but for windowed software, with lowercase w, graphical interfaces, that sort of thing. And he worked at Xerox PARC, the famous Palo Alto Research Center, and him and the teams he was involved with did a lot of pioneering work. He had colleagues, Tesler did the first laser printer, I believe. Metcalf worked on early Ethernet there.
Right.
And those guys did the GUI that they did, and not just the GUI, but the kind of applications to take, the kind of office-y applications to take advantage of the GUI. So they did a lot of really, really neat things.
And they didn't invent the mouse, but they licensed it from Douglas Engelbart, and they, I guess you could say, they pre-perfected it.
It's kind of weird to me how the mouse might have been invented before the GUI. I don't really know if I understand that entirely. How did they use it if there wasn't anything? I don't really know if they understand.
Well, the work that Douglas Engelbart did, it was, I guess it was a GUI, wasn't it? It was graphical.
Yeah, you should look up Engelbart and the One Big Demo.
Yeah, I have that on a VHS.
Well, there's a couple of books I recommend. It's actually three good books. I have, there's a book called Bootstrapping, which is Engelbart's biography. There's a wonderful book called Dealers of Lightning. Mm-hmm. By a guy named Michael Hiltzik, all about PARC. And anyway, so
Michael Nadeau brought that up on last show or the one before.
Oh, did he? Okay.
Yeah.
And there's another book, not as well known, called The Dream Machine, not to be confused with Dream Machines by Ted Nelson.
I was going to ask.
And that's what everyone thought, yeah. And Dream Machine isn't as sensational as Dealers of Lightning, but it's better researched, and it's more of a real history book versus just a casual book.
I am M. Mitchell Wardrop.
That's right.
Yeah, J.C.R. Licklider and the Revolution That Made Computing Personal.
Right. So I recommend all three of those books. Anyway, I wanted to interview Alan a couple years ago because I'm writing this book about the history of portable computing. And, of course, he's famous for Dynabook and The Note Taker. So I first contacted him in January 2008, and I said, Mr. K, it's my honor to meet you, blah, blah, and I'd like to interview you questions. And he basically gave me homework. he said, I'll answer your questions, but first you have to read X, Y, and Z.
That'll teach you to talk to celebrities.
Yeah, right. So he actually gave me homework. So I read a couple documents he had written, and he referred me to that Dream Machine book, and then I wrote back to him almost 2 years later in December 2009, and I said, okay, now I've read your documents, now may I have the right to ask you questions. So he answered some interesting technical things for me about the Dynabook and the Note Taker. But one of the questions, and I'll divulge those in my book, but what I wanted to talk about here is I asked him, there's so much that's been written about PARC and what he's done. I asked him if in his opinion, there's anything new to say. And he said, well, that he thinks a lot of writers kind of missed the point that it wasn't about the hardware. It wasn't about a product. It was about a beautiful artistic concept. And then he went on this long rant about companies don't put enough R&D dollars in today. And I sure read about that, he says.
Yeah, it was about the user experience, and Alan was especially intrigued by he did a lot of case studies with children,
mm-hmm.
and how they would use something with no prior knowledge or
right, and that's it also gets the small talk language as well. But he kept emphasizing, and this is very important, that when he first came up with the concept for Dynabook, and people forget people talk about the Dynabook today as if it were a product or a prototype. There was no Dynabook. You never made one. All Dynabook was a document saying someone should ought to, somebody someday could make such a thing. You know, you never had
that. I heard there was a cardboard prototype.
Yeah. Well, I've read that too.
But people talk about Dynabook as if it were a thing, and it wasn't. It was an idea. Later on, by about 75, his colleagues made the Note Taker, which was kind of an Osborne-like luggable, long before the Osborne. But he basically explained how, you know, the Note Taker was something he settled for. It was an interim Dynabook, he referred to it as.
Right.
It was basically the Xerox Alto software in a smaller package. And something like the iPad is what he had in mind, but he just couldn't do it with the hardware then. But he calculated that it ought to be feasible by the 80s or 90s, and he was pretty close. So anyway, that's the main thing he wanted to emphasize, and the main thing he told me that he wants, you know, writers to emphasize is that it was all about the software. It wasn't about inventing a portable computer. It was about making a personal and portable computing experience for children.
Yeah, and I think
he's the guy who said people who really love software should do their own hardware, which is
right. And he also said the best way to predict the future is to invent.
Yeah,
you beat me. That's my favorite quote I've had for years. Not that I'm the only one.
So anyway, back to full circle. So he turned 70 just a few months ago, and giants of the computer science world came together to basically have a party for him. And I forget which one it was, but one of them said to themselves, you know, what could you possibly give Alan Kay? I mean, you know, what could you give a man like that? So they decided to write a book in his honor. And they each wrote an essay and put it in this anthology dedicated to Alan Kay. So that's what the document is. And you can download it for free on the website of the Viewpoint Research Institute, which is Alan's latest NSF-funded deal, or you could, for a modest price, they'll print you a hardcover version.
Had to write an essay for his 70th birthday card. Boy, I sweat whenever birthday cards are passed around the office and I have to write one sentence.
So that's what I have to say about Alan Kay.
Yeah, that's always been one of my favorite quotes, though. Yeah, you know, the best way to predict the future is to
invent it.
Exactly. As I say, one other thing is, I believe that kind of, as far as the Dynabook, the only hardware requirements were pretty simple that I think he proposed, or he foresaw that it would be the power of a supercomputer and the size of a book. And that's about it, right?
Yeah.
In its simplest form.
I don't know if I put it that way, but
I think I'd read that.
I don't know. I hadn't seen that before.
The next topic is, this is something, John, you brought to the table. It says, Pirate Bay founder says Apple becoming Microsoft, quote unquote, with Mac App Store.
And I think it's pretty much just ridiculous. I wanted to see what you all thought. It would be one thing if Apple was saying, all right, the only way you can install software on our computers from now on is through the App Store. To me, it's simply a means for people who are just getting a computer, which there's, you know, we're geeks, we're surrounded by mostly other geeks. You know, we know what we're doing. There are a lot of people out there who, you know, this Christmas probably got computers for the first time or Macintoshes for the first time. Mm-hmm. I think the App Store.
For the first time in 2000? No.
We had a
customer get a computer for the first time in 2010.
We had a customer come into our where I work about 3 months ago that didn't know how to use a mouse. Just saying. And this is on, you know,
what was the demographics of that customer?
An Air Force base. So
did everyone stand in unison, point and laugh?
We were polite and waited till after they left. So, but all I'm saying is, you know, there are people out there, and this is a good, safe way. They know they're getting software that's been checked for malware and so forth. But it's by no means, you know, Apple becoming Microsoft is my feeling.
And I was really worried when I heard about this App Store thing. Oh, no, we're not going to be able to turn it off. They're going to integrate it into the OS. No, it's just an application. You don't like it, you delete it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I can add that this Christmas – so actually my kids have had computers before now, but my two older kids are teenagers. They just got brand new laptops, and they have Steam now. And I have Steam on my computer for the first time. And so I bought a game through Steam. So, my God, is, you know, Valve becoming Microsoft too?
What is Steam?
Steam is – do you know who Valve Software is? They made
no,
They made Half-Life, and I'm not a big gamer, but it's essentially the same thing, an online app store for games.
Oh, I see.
So you don't have to buy media. You download it. And it works fantastic. It's great.
And it's all copy-protected.
It is, but I don't know. I'm an iPod user, so that kind of... I have a lot of that sort of thing with music, so I don't know if that bothers me. Does that bother you, Derek? That's copy-protected, or...? Most games are, aren't they, anyway?
Usually way around it, so it doesn't bother me too much, but I've never... I'm not really an app guy. I'm an old-fashioned desktop guy. You know, I think I've purchased maybe 3 apps in the 2 years I've had my iPod Touch.
Yeah, and like I said, I'm not a big gamer anyway, but that just came to mind, is that, you know, to me, Steam certainly is sort of the same. It's the same model, right, as the App Store.
Well, Atari had that model in the 1970s, I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I forget what it was called, but the Atari had a service whereby you could hook up your modem and download games. And I might get the lineage wrong, the exact chronology wrong, but I believe that became a spin-out, and that led to, was it CompuServe or AOL? There was some kind of relationship there in a series of spin-outs from Atari all the way to CompuServe and Chuck E. Cheese and Nolan Bushnell and stuff.
I'm laughing because I'm looking at the first two comments about this article. And
oh, yes.
The first person says, sigh, how could someone be smart enough to start and run Pirate Bay and be such a complete idiot at the same time? Nothing he says here is true, and there's no evidence whatsoever to back up these paranoid claims, but that won't stop people believing it, I suppose. And the next person goes, he's just upset because he's going to jail.
Oh, I just remembered. It was called that. It became Quantum Link.
Oh, okay.
Quantum Link is what I think led into
Okay. Yeah,
and AOL.
At first, an exclusive Commodore 64 service before it evolved into AOL on the Macintosh.
I forget what it was called, but there was an Atari thing where you could download games at one point, but I forget. I'd have to look up the details.
And, it was called Your Local Where's BBS. No.
John, when you added this topic, it made me remember a podcast I just listened to called the I Cringely. You know, his blog, and he does a little podcast where he reads it. You guys remember Robert X. Cringely?
A.K.A. Mark Stevens.
Oh, yeah, I didn't know his real name. But, you know, he did those series, The Triumph of the Nerds, that came out on PBS in the 90s. But he did 10 predictions for 2011. And so, kind of in the same line here, his number 7 prediction was, Microsoft is the new IBM. And in a nutshell, he says, you know, Microsoft isn't going away, but they aren't going to do a lot of things right in 2011. And he goes on to elaborate more on that.
That's a stretch.
But I guess he's trying to say that they're going to remain successful, profitable, big, but they're just not as important as they used to be.
Just kind of going off their own momentum at this point.
Yeah, speaking of momentum.
That's not a prediction. That happened in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
That's not a prediction. That's already true now.
Yeah.
And the knock-on effect, he says, is that Google is now the new Microsoft,
how is that a prediction? That's
right, right. You're right. It's not really. But I think he's right. I mean, I think
And in the comments, my favorite comment, IBM, what does that make IBM? Second comment, IBM is the new GM?
Ooh.
Well, as a former PC Week guy, I'm more partial to Spencer Catt than Robert Cringely.
I'm trying to think of other such guys. I think in Mac Week, wasn't there like something the knife or something was sort of the other side
Mac
of thing?
Knife.
Mac the knife, yeah. I mostly read Mac magazines in the day. So, the next item is I got a really nice email from a gentleman in Germany. So he hails from the Oldenburger Computer Museum, which is in Oldenburger, Germany. And I looked on the map, and it's kind of in northwestern Germany.
Now, is that a real museum, or is it just, you know, some guy's collection and calls it a museum?
No. It's a very hands-on, interactive museum. Take a look at the link there. It looks pretty nice. And a lot of nice pictures. They have a lot of fun. And they've got a lot of young people involved. Okay. And I believe I say his name right. It's Theimo. So Theimo Edix. He says, hi, my name is Theimo Edix. I run the only hands-on retro computer museum in Germany. I just started to listen to the RCR today, and I'm halfway through the first show while I'm writing this. I must say, great. I'm listening to Earl for about a year now, and I am very glad to hear there are so many more of us, quote-unquote, collectors. It's very interesting to hear what system seems to be important to you, and that you look at German eBay items, too. Keep on doing this great podcast. Greetings from North Germany, Theimo Edix. And he's from the Oldenburger Computer Museum in Oldenburg. Okay, it's the name of the town. But yeah, he's got, you know, just some nice pictures there and information about the museum. It looks like a fun place. I wish I could go visit.
Yeah, and of course, you know, if he ever could, you'd also have to visit the Heinz Nickdorf Museum, which is a, you know, a big time museum.
That's a corporate museum for the company?
That's correct.
Okay.
And there's also, of course, VCF Europa in Munich every year.
Yeah, has it been going on every year, or has it been sort of a lapse recently?
I've been so busy doing my own, I lost track. But that's run by Hans Franke, who's a great guy out there. Mm-hmm. And Hans is a big-time collector. I think they do it every year, but I haven't really heard from him in a while.
Yeah, this Oldenburger, it looks like they have a blast at this place. And definitely a nice mix of, you know, older and younger people, and people really enjoying the old machines. They're, like, playing with them. A lot of gaming, you know, vintage gaming going on, and they're doing dress up and barbecuing and
all ages, all genders.
Crafts. It's like, wow, yeah. But you know,
all of them.
It seems to me that you know, Europe is, and Germany especially, just kind of has appreciated older 8-bit computers anyway, more so. It's been my impression. I think they were just kind of used longer there.
I wanted to jump in mm-hmm. with something about how the Amiga and the Atari ST were way more popular in Germany and the rest of Europe than they were in North America, but I can't think of anything succinct to say.
I think it was more variety in Europe. There wasn't, you know, one. So it wasn't just Commodore Apple like it was in the U.S. You know, there was a lot more variety out there.
And there was the CPC, too, was pretty big. Am I saying that right?
CPC?
The Amstrad?
Is that what it was? Yeah. Amstrad, maybe, Amstrad, yeah. Yes. It's been a while since I've thought of it, but I lived in Germany for almost 2 years, and I would occasionally buy a German magazine, even though I couldn't read it, computer magazine, and I'd look through it. Am I right, guys? Is that what it was, the Amstrad CPC?
Yeah, there were several. There were several of those.
Because this was the early 90s, and I would look at, like, the classifieds, and I would see those all the time. Yeah, so the Amstrad CPC, color personal computer, discontinued in 1990. All right, well, let's move on to the next item of interest here. It's just something called the Visual 6502 Simulator. This is off a retro thing.
This is so cool.
And basically, what it says is, it talks about how the MOS technology 6502 became the inexpensive heart of Apple and Commodore computers and the Atari. It's been impossible to actually watch one work until now. Greg at Visual 6502 spent 6 weeks creating a working transistor-level visual simulation of this classic chip by aligning and combining over 200 microscopic photographs. And there's more information there, but it's an amazing picture just to look at. So
yeah, and
it can be a piece of art.
Not to derail the topic too much, but if you're interested in the history of the 6502, the 27th Chaos Communication Congress was just held in Germany, and Michael Steil, who also did the ultimate C64 talk, gives a long, detailed history about the 6502 and how it works in 1 hour. You know, you can't ask for the original design docs because there was no electronic documentation. It was all done by hand.
Well, you can ask Chuck Peddle. And at our VCF a couple years ago, he gave a keynote, and it's all on YouTube. It's in four parts on YouTube. I think it starts about 15 or 16 minutes into the first part. You could just Google on YouTube for Chuck Peddle, you know, VCF keynote, and it was the first time in 30 years he had come out of the closet and given a talk about 6502, you know, right from the inventor himself.
And the book, the new version of that book, On the Edge.
Ah, yes.
That's about to come out, which gives you a lot of information about those, the 6502 and the history of Commodore and so on, too.
I heard something about the 6502. Maybe you guys can confirm this for me. Since they had to do the layout by hand, they didn't have any computer design tools. They had to do it all on paper. They needed a really big piece of paper, you know, to do the... so it was all this paper was suspended, you know, from the ceiling along this one office wall. And I heard that there was a little section in the bottom right-hand corner of the 6502 die where there was an electrical outlet in the wall, and they needed those electrical outlets, so they just designed around the outlet. So there was this little hole in the bottom right-hand corner of the 6502 die. Is that true?
I think that might have been in the book. I think that there might have been something about that in the book there, because it sounds familiar to me, but I'm not sure. I seem to remember something about you having to use paper. Nobody knows for sure.
I'll have to do what they did and take some sulfuric acid to a 6502 so I can expose the die so I can check it out. Just whip out my electron microscope.
a couple more items here, and pretty quick ones. So I wanted to mention that Zoe Blade, who did the music for the GitLamp documentary by Jason Scott, she just announced that she has a new ambient techno album. And I enjoyed a lot of that music from that documentary. you know, if you're into that. So so I just wanted to mention that. There's a link in the show notes. And I thought I'd play, she has one selection here called Winter on the main page. So I thought I'd play, you know, 20 seconds or so of it. But if you enjoyed that music, you can download it and you can make a, or you can buy it, 13 tracks for £5, whatever that works out to be.
It's a great accompaniment to your favorite text adventure as well. It's very slow, almost kind of struggles to evolve, and it reminds me of the frustrating load times for the hybrid graphical text adventures when you wait for the next screen to load.
So I'm going to switch to speakers here and see if I can record this. So hold on a second. I guess that's very ambient.
Yeah.
You know, nice kind of stuff to have in the background. Or foreground. Hey. Okay, last thing is we are coming up on a huge event for the Computer History Museum, Mountain View, California. So they've been announcing this for quite a while. See, so it's called Revolution, the first 2,000 years of computing. So it is going to open up on the 13th. So from this recording, that's 5 days from now. I don't know, do any of you know more about this? I know there's just it's a whole new museum, you know,
well,
area.
I wish I could be there. You know, that museum has been open for several years now, and they've always had one or two very narrow exhibits. They've had the history of computer chess. They've had the PDP-1 restoration, the IBM 14, the IBM Stretch restoration, et cetera. But the vast majority of their exhibits they've had what they call visual storage, which is a warehouse, but, you know, it's a nicely laid out warehouse. And then behind the scenes, they have a warehouse, and then they have an offsite warehouse to supplement it. The visual storage was always interested, and it was, you know, small, modest exhibits with simple labels, but it wasn't really curated. So now that they've turned that around and made a real exhibit out of it, and this is the big one that we've all been waiting for, I personally can't wait to see it. I wish I can go. I know that, I was an advisor for their portable computing exhibit. So if anyone goes and sees it, please take a picture. My name should be on there somewhere. That's basically the gist is that they've, after 5 or 6 years of being out there, they finally made the real one. You know, they're finally out of beta and they made the one massive history exhibit we've all been waiting for.
Right. And I know on a, you know, a recent show here in the RCR, we covered about, you know, Steve Wozniak did a walkthrough of, I guess, was he walking through the old,
I believe he was walking through the new part.
The new part that wasn't done yet. Okay.
And I heard that from Eric Klein, who runs Vintage Computer Forum, you know, vintage-computer.com/VC Forum. And Eric's one of the top docents at the CHM. And Eric was guiding Steve.
Okay. I didn't know that. I know that was him.
Mm-hmm.
Well, guys, let's move into, we're going to quickly just go over last show's eBay auctions. So the first one was by Bill Degnan, and it was a copy. He had more to say about this versus just this particular auction, but it's a 1975 Popper Electronics issue, which featured the Altair 680 computer kit. So after three bids, it sold for $21.49. November 75. So this is the one just, is that what it is? November 75? Yeah, okay, so this is after the, obviously, the original Altair issue. And I got that right? It was January 75, wasn't it, for the original Altair issue?
I believe so.
Yeah, because this is definitely later on.
The original wouldn't have been that cheap.
Yeah, right, because it's 680. All right, the second item was from Earl Evans, and it's a new Apple IIc 1985 portable computer set, sealed boxes.
And we just talked to the person who won this auction
on your show today.
Scott. Ooh. And you'll be able to hear him talk about it on there if you want to.
After five bids, $4,995. John, I don't listen to your show, man.
Somebody paid $4,000 for an Apple IIc? That's crazy.
Well, the whole thing is I would never pay for it, but it's the whole thing was sealed in boxes. It's never been.
But
I know.
I wouldn't have paid $400 for now. I wouldn't.
Well,
nothing against the Apple IIc. It's a nice little computer, but I
they already killed the images on the auction.
It's insane.
Well, I mean,
three years ago, there was that guy who paid $2,700, I think it was, for a 2C and an image writer.
Yeah.
And that was already pushing it. I mean, crazy. Maybe it was 2C plus.
And he opened those, too. He did an unboxing on those. But
And what was his name again, John?
Scott.
Scott. So is he opening this one?
He is not. He is not.
Oh, he's not. Okay.
He's going to keep these. He's already warned his family to stay away from the boxes. So.
Does he have kids?
I don't get it.
Yes.
Yeah, a couple of years from now. Daddy, we found this in the closet. Look, it's fun. We were playing it all day.
If it had been an original Apple II, I could understand it. But what's so special about a 2C?
I
would have to agree. I don't think I could ever pay that much. I would rather have a computer out that I can play with.
Mm-hmm.
And then, just the wow.
I don't know that I would have $500 for a 2C.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a 2C plus.
You know, what would be interesting is if Scott did a sort of experiment. I don't know if it wouldn't be very controlled, but I guess, you know, theoretically, if you take an Apple 2C, you know, or any old computer, let's say an Apple 2C, and like I have one that's old and used and it works, you know, theoretically, how long will it keep working, you know, on average? So let's say, I'm just going to throw something out there, let's say 20 years. Well, if it's from 80, most of these are from the late 80s, so it's already over 20 years old, right?
Mm-hmm.
So let's say 30 years, maybe it'll work as long as you take, you know, reasonable care of it and climate controlled, and you know it'll keep working. At some point, it will fail, right?
Yeah. So, but you can take care of that because what you really need to go along with your $5,000 2C is a $62 screwdriver to open it up.
Well, so my question here is that. Let's say that this box is kept sealed and, you know, and in well-kept climate control, I think, for 100 years. When you open it up, will it work?
Yeah, but you'll be dead by then.
Well, I know. I'm just saying, theoretically, 100 years, 200 years from now.
I would say the only thing that you would have to worry about, and I don't know if this is a problem for these, would be if there's capacitors.
Yeah, will they fail even though they've never been used?
Capacitors can actually start drying out after so many years.
Even if it's still
says there are capacitors involved.
Fail too, you know? I don't know. I don't. Anybody who spends that much money on such a non-important computer is crazy.
I guess it's relative, though. Like I think we discussed this on the show. You know, for some, maybe it was the Apple Lisa or something that went for a lot of money, or Apple One, maybe. I think it was maybe.
Well, sure, an Apple One, even the original Apple II, a Lisa, first Mac, but
yeah.
C is nothing.
Maybe this though, $5,000 to him is like, you know, $50 to me.
Maybe.
So,
I think I also think part of the problem is all the early Apple that have been in the news,
yeah.
You know, kind of pushing the prices up of what is considered a collectible.
And John, you know that the Retro MacCast is my favorite podcast. So,
well,
I was kidding.
I've got it. The 2C is a first example of a highly designed product of Steve Jobs that is completely sealed, not expandable, but incredibly good looking.
And it's the epitome of the Snow White design language.
Exactly. There you go.
So next auction was from Jason Scott. And he did two. So the first one was, well, actually he spoke about the next screwdriver. So he did rare, next computer screwdriver, next cube, next station. And it sold for, actually surprisingly, after four bids, $61.77. For a next logo screwdriver.
For such a highly designed item, it's very boxy. It's not rounded at all. It's got to be really hard to turn.
Yeah.
Steve.
But satisfying. And
only if you paid $62 for it, I think.
His next one was video games and computer ENT extremely rare 11th issue. And I think he chose this as he made some point about it too, as far as I don't remember now exactly, but it sold for it's still for sale. It's on sale for $26.36, and the sale ends in 9 hours as of right now, so it has not sold. And lastly was mine, an old Commodore MOS, and this is the description, old Commodore MOS Technology 6502 Kim-1 SBC computer, which after 25 bids sold for $455.
Not bad.
So, Evan, what do you think about that one? I think that's probably, you know, somewhat realistic, right? For
depending on the condition, that's not a bad deal.
I believe, did it say it didn't work, though? Nice condition, but I am selling this untested, of course.
Of course.
But I believe we discussed that it was not a Commodore-branded one. So I guess that makes it a little more rare. more original.
Yeah, and I guess there are a limited number of people
depends.
Who would...
So there was originally there was the MOS version, mm-hmm. then there was a Commodore version, and someone correct me, but weren't there other companies that also licensed it post-MOS?
Ooh, not sure.
I'm not sure either. I want to say I don't think so, but I can't say that authoritatively. I know there are other similar devices like this, but
right. I thought they had sold it to some other companies beside Commodore after
MOS. It's very popular, and maybe they weren't called Kims, though.
Right, right.
But yeah. All right, so Derek, let's you go ahead and start off with your auction this time. For this time. I kind of moved around the order that we were in from the last show just to change it up.
So my auction this time, I'm on a bit of a text adventure and adventure game streak, so I
love this
found
game.
A boxed copy of Task Times in Toontown for the Commodore 64 mm-hmm. going for $15 US, and it caught my attention because it was there and somebody had actually bid on it. So this comes with the Toontown Times newspaper, which is, don't tell anyone, the copy protection key. And yeah, just a nice looking thing of a game that nobody seems to have heard of in the text adventure world.
I have this game for the 2GS, and
I hear it was one of the first commercial games for the 2GS.
It's a lot of fun, and I've seen some of these go on eBay before, and they actually, how much time has this got left? It's got 2 days and 6 hours with one bid for $15. I say it'll probably sell for closer to $50, believe it or not.
Hmm.
But
John, as a 2GS user, have you ever played this?
No, I have not. I have not played that one.
I think you'd appreciate the weird 80s punk rock aesthetic.
And let me point everyone to our bud, Carrington Vanston's podcast, the 1 MHz Apple II podcast.
Yes.
And he covered this game in his very first episode, 28 minutes or so. So he covers this game very, very much in this. And if you listen to that podcast, it'll really get you – great podcast. Really love it. It'll get you kind of nostalgic and pumped up about this game. It's what made me seek it out, listening to his podcast. Well, John, you go ahead next.
All right. This is an interesting find. If you're a collector that doesn't have a lot of space, this particular system will cover a lot for you.
Drool.
It's a Macintosh. Yes, it's a Macintosh Cutler Classic. First thing that's interesting about it is it's been upgraded to 640 by 480. The original mm-hmm. Cutler Classic was 512 by 382. 384. Did I say? Yeah. All right. Anyway, so that's the first cool thing. Now you can play any of the 640 by 480 games. The next thing is he's replaced the motherboard with one that had a 60 LC040 processor, which he has then replaced the LC040 with a straight up 040 processor.
And he replaced the board, so it's probably got a 32-bit data bus. Am I right?
Yes.
Is this a Color Classic 2 motherboard?
No, because the Color Classic 2 is still an 030, so this is an 040 board.
Okay, I couldn't read that because he's got the auction description in a tiny little inline frame, and it's like, I'm trying to read the whole thing through a mailbox slot.
Yeah, if I can add the slot or the tray rather that the logic board slides into, in the back of this chassis, it's exactly the same as a Quadra 630 or the entire PowerPC like 6200 series. So you could upgrade this just by pulling the logic board out and sliding in up to a like the logic board out of a 6400. I think off the top of my head at 180 megahertz.
It's a totally different cable structure inside. You have to totally do a custom cable for like 6400.
Okay,
which I've done one of those, but no, this one it's
like this is essentially a Quadra, like a 630 logic board slid into it. Am I right?
Like if I'm remembering, like the a 575, a Performa 575 board slides right.
Okay, thank you. You're right.
Yeah. But anyway, that is not the last of the really cool things. The last of the really cool things is this also has the Apple IIe card in it, which means it will run Apple IIe software. Natively, it's not an emulator.
Hmm. All wish the guy all, had slid the board out.
Yeah,
need to look
yeah,
at it.
It would have been so. All in all, he's asking for a buy-in price of $400, but he also does have a best offer.
Doesn't appear to come with the Y adapter for the.
No, it does not. And the problem with that is if you can find the Y adapter, that's what you need to hook up an external floppy, and an Apple IIe joystick. So.
My question is, I'm sure we're coming to a point in time too where a original Color Classic may actually start to become more valuable than anyone that's modded. So I wonder if this will sell for $400. It'll be interesting to see. Mm-hmm. Or when do we come to the point where, again, an unmodded Color Classic will be more desirable to a collector?
Maybe on its 20th birthday in 2013.
Well, there you go.
And Evan, I'm sorry for all the Max slant.
I'm not offended.
Yeah, I'm just saying. I realize now between Derek and me and John, we're kind of definitely a little more Mackie-ish. So Evan, you go ahead with your item now.
Well, I had a hard time finding ones. I was looking through eBay ads, and there's a lot of crap out there, for sure.
Yeah.
So I saw an ad for only around $10. Somebody selling the July 73 issue, or maybe it was July 74, I forget which, of Radio Electronics, which was a TV typewriter issue. So I bought that for myself. Yeah. Sorry, listeners, I bought that for myself.
Very inconsiderate of you.
Sometimes you see something that you think is a good deal, but you realize it's actually not. There was a book by Les Solomon and Stan Veit called Getting Involved with Your Own Computer, mm-hmm. A Guide for Beginners. It was $39, and it's all about the Apple One and the Kim and a lot of neat out there. And I thought, that's not a bad deal. But just out of curiosity, I looked on a couple of bookstore sites on the web, and it's available everywhere for like $5.
Mm.
So it turns out it is a bad deal. But it's a neat book, and it's available everywhere really cheap. So I'd recommend picking up that book. It sounds like you can't go wrong with that interesting book and that price.
Well, and I'm looking on Amazon real quick because what you just said, and there's other places, A Books, obviously.
There's a site I really like. It's kind of not well known. There's no www. The site is used, so USED. .addall.com. And used.addall.com is nothing but a used bookstore. But it's an aggregator. So it looks at Bookfinder and Amazon and A-Books. So it's an aggregator of used bookstore sites. And it's a really hidden secret. I recommend it, right? And then you could sort it by price. And there's a bunch of copies here for like $4.70 of this really interesting book.
In Amazon, you know, I found it here too because I was at this site. So it's showing 7 used from $4.70.
Yeah,
paying $40. This is the first thing I always do before. And then there's been times though where I've found it through here A Books, and then I go search on eBay, and I have actually found it less as often, but I found it cheaper on eBay.
Never found that, but I found brand new books for sale used, like brand new, new copies and stuff. And a lot of new books these days are easily $30, $40, $50, $60. I'll go on use.addall.com, and once in a while I'll find something for, $7. And I'm sorry, sorry for the, as an author myself, I wish people would buy the expensive ones. But as a poor person myself, I love this. So,
Derek and John, do you guys know who Leslie Solomon was?
I do not.
I'm afraid not.
And Evan, help me out. He was the.
Get an F.
He was
Les Solomon was the original editor.
Like the computer editor, right?
Was it Radio Electronics?
Popular Electronics.
And of course, he was involved with the Homebrew Computer Club and everything else.
Yeah, with the Altair, and then there was a computer called the Soul that was named after him and in his honor.
Right, and that was made by Lee Felsenstein, who later went on to do the Osborne.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, the last item we have is what I did this time, because I was kind of having a difficulty of determining what auction I wanted to cover, what direction, whatever. So I cheated a little bit, I guess, is I simply did a search in the category of vintage computing and the search term rare. So I thought this might bring up some good discussion. So if you click on the link in the show notes like I just did, so this is live at this moment, it brings up 1,278 results, 611 other under other, 264 under Apple, 111 under vintage PCs. Then it breaks down further. I won't cover them all, but Atari, IBM, Commodore. Those are roughly in the 80s, 90s. So anyway, in the search that I set up and I linked to, it's doing it by way of best match. So some listeners, by the time you see this, some of these items won't be here because they'll have ended. But like the first one up with 35 minutes left has not sold yet for $15. It's an IBM PowerPC 601 CPU, very rare, 90 megahertz version aqua color. is that really that rare? So I just thought this might start some discussion of what's rare, what's not rare. So maybe you guys look down, if you notice something. There's a couple of tubes in here that look interesting. Processors.
It's definitely a word that gets used way too much on eBay.
Kind of my point.
And just to call back to the last show, you definitely picked the right search term, David, because look with two O's in it only pulls up 172 results. Two zeros.
Or they'll use two at signs.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, I didn't try that.
Yeah. I mean, so looking on this one page at the moment here, the you know, closest thing I see to being, you know, sort of rare, at least in a computer, is this Osborne, you know, OCC1.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they're not that rare, right?
They're not that rare.
Oh, you guys are playing in the basement here. I just looked up look with two at signs in it. 98,662.
See, I told you.
Did you do that under just computers though? Is that all of eBay?
You got to consider alternative spellings.
Computers here. Let's see.
And I'm going to click into vintage PCs where there's 111, and this might be a little more interesting. Let's see. Now, this is kind of interesting.
Only 1,110 results for look with at symbols in it in the computer section.
First
of which is a Dell Latitude.
Wait, what'd you say, a Dell Latitude? I better look.
It's a D610, guaranteed to be at least 3 years old.
That's awesome. Here is something interesting. When I clicked over to the category vintage PCs, there's a vintage analog computer, old, rare.
Which one?
It just says vintage. Oh, there's more. Vintage analog computer, old, rare. $125, buy it now.
You don't know what kind it is?
Let me scroll down here. So you were buying, blah, blah, blah. Let's see. Here's someone asking, I could not locate any on the machine as far as what manufacturer and model it is. Rapid City, South Dakota.
Let's see here.
Yeah, it looks kind of, maybe it's homebrewed there.
Whoa, that's a weird looking thing.
Okay, so I'm looking through the rares that, on here. All right, so I find Mac Plus Computer, vintage rare original computer. This thing looks like it was pulled out of the Lisa landfill. And he has a buy it now price of $185 for a Mac Plus.
Yeah, what is interesting? This was discussed on the CC Talk list just a couple of days ago. Some company, I think it was a recycling company or a scrapper, was selling an IBM 026 key punch for only $500, which on the surface sounds like a very good deal, but again, looked like it came out of the landfill. It looked to be very rusty and corroded, so it wasn't as good a deal as it seemed. But still, an 026, I mean, that's only the second one they ever made after the 024. Mm-hmm. So if anyone wants a key punch and is willing to put a lot of effort into cleaning it up, that could be a good deal for someone looking to do a serious restoration.
When it comes to, you know, pieces of hardware or these computers or whatever, I really don't understand why someone can't take 5 minutes with some Windex and paper towels and just wipe something off, just do a real basic wipe off.
Mm-hmm. Not Windex. No strong solids.
Well, I mean, it's not going to hurt metal. I mean, if you're just getting the surface dirt off, right?
This thing was rusted and corroded. So
okay. Yeah. But I just mean even some of these other people's stuff is just as dirty. That's why not just do something? I mean, I know in the Antiques Roadshow, they don't want you like trying to clean old wood furniture with polish or anything, but that's kind of different. So now we'll get ready to wrap up the show. I think we're doing pretty good time-wise. So again, I want to thank everyone for being on. Anybody have anything else to add or about what you're doing or what's going on? Derek, I guess we'll go to you.
I wanted to add that, I got a studio set up to continue Mac Folklore Radio. I don't think I'm going to continue beyond what Andy has written, though, because it's been a real pain so far. If I knew it was going to take this long, I wouldn't have done it.
Because you're going from the actual website versus, like, the book. Is that right?
A bit of both. The book has a lot of editing and corrections that were badly needed.
Uh-huh.
And I did have a retro challenge warm-up project. I was going to live 1 month exclusively at home and at work on OpenStep, but that really fell apart when I found that, you know, even the Google homepage doesn't even render very well in OmniWeb 3, and the idea of writing my own applications to do this and that, not as practical as I thought it would be.
Maybe you could limit it to just like in the evening or something like that.
Maybe.
Or outside of work or...
Boy, I don't know what I'm doing wrong, but running OpenStep in even VMware Fusion is quite a nightmare with drivers and things like that.
Or just run OpenStep only and read real books. Here I am with OpenStep running, but I'm not doing anything with it. Well, that's good to hear that you're going to do some more episodes of Mac Folklore Radio. You're my hero because, you know, I'm doing an audio book and I try to be you.
It's definitely tough. Don't follow my schedule.
I'm behind, you know, on the Stan Veit, but I'm very determined to. I'm working on chapter 4 now. Okay, and John, so you continue to do the Retro MacCast. You just did an episode this morning, and pretty much you guys do one almost pretty much every week. I mean, you have occasional exceptions like the holidays here recently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had a 2-week hiatus for the holidays, but we're pretty steady. And if I can't make it, I know this guy in Canada that's quite good at filling in.
And so, again, this morning was your 200th episode?
No, we'll still have a little ways to go before we get to the 200th episode. We just had our 4-year anniversary.
That's right. Well, you know, and no pressure, but I hope you guys might consider doing a video again, you know, with maybe your 200th.
I think that's the plan right now, either at his place or my place.
And fly Derek down?
That would be awesome.
Okay. Well, and thanks again. I know it's a tight, especially tight schedule for you to be on. I really appreciate it. So, hopefully, all of you guys, of course, hopefully stay in the regular schedule. So, Evan?
Yes.
So, tell me what you're up to. I know you're planning for the Vintage Computer Festival in May.
Yeah, we're nagging Salam to get the website up for that. Our museum's open every Sunday, but starting this week, we're going to close for a few weeks and work on inventory and cataloging. We're overdue for that. Hopefully, we'll reopen within a month or so. Did a fun rescue the other day of a Data General Eclipse. That was a fun moving a rack from someone's basement upstairs was very interesting. and it just barely fit into the back of a Chevy Suburban. That was fun.
Nobody was injured, I hope.
Egos.
What time frame is that from?
This was an eclipse from about
like early 80s or
I don't know.
I'm not that familiar.
It was an Eclipse S130, one of the first eclipses, so I'm not sure exactly what the time frame of that is. I'd have to look that up.
Here we go. Let's see. 16-bit mini computers released in early 74 and sold until 88.
The S130 was one of the early versions, so mid-70s.
Okay. It says based on many of the same concepts as the Nova, but included support for virtual memory and multitasking.
And it was in a whole rack, and we took the drive out. The drive itself was 120 pounds.
Wow.
So, one guy pulling, one guy pushing on this big, cart with the tread on the back. And we finally got outside, and it was snowing outside, so it was an interesting day. But
We didn't talk about weather, which I know who wants to, small talk, but I want to bring it up because, I live in the Atlanta area. I live about 35 miles north of downtown, I guess.
Small talk, Alan Gay reference.
There you go. But I'm looking out the window right now. It's 12:22 in the afternoon on Saturday. It's beautiful outside. It's like, I'm guessing, I think it's like 50 degrees, upper mid-50s, sunny, clear, blue sky. But the weather forecast for our area is it's going to be bad. So it's supposed to start.
What's your definition of bad?
Well,
there?
Bad for here. Because you got to remember, obviously, people don't know how to deal with this stuff here. Anyway, it's different than people used to it in the north. But it's supposed to, we're supposed to maybe get like the entire northern part of the county and the Atlanta area, like 2 or 3 inches of snow with ice. But believe me, for here, that's bad. That's like it shuts everything down.
It's pretty funny.
We're not equipped for it, you know?
I live 12 miles outside of Manhattan.
I know.
I'm right outside New York City, and, a couple weeks ago, we had 2.5 feet.
Yeah.
And even that was considered a huge blizzard for out here. But the people, my friend in Minnesota was laughing at us. People, you close for that?
But, so you're where you live, they have the infrastructure and they're equipped to handle it.
Right.
Snow plows
right.
And, I guess, salting the roads and whatever right. else. And certainly they handle that here, too, but it's bad. because it snowed right at Christmas time here, too, just a little bit, but it shuts things down. So I'm not sure if I'm going into work on Monday, which I wouldn't be too upset about.
Yeah, well, shucks, right? We don't get snow days down in Florida. We get hurricane days. So,
right, right. Yeah, and I've been through a few of those because I'm from Florida. So and went through a hurricane in Virginia, too. Atlanta probably misses it somewhat being inland.
But by the time they get up here, they're just storms.
Yeah.
I remember when I was a child, it was Hurricane, I don't know, Andrew, whatever it was. And by the time it got to New Jersey, it was just a storm. So my brother and his friends were in high school. They got themselves some beer and they had a hurricane on the front porch. And at one point, the glass in the front door of my parents' house broke, and my brother and his friends tried to convince my parents it was hurricane damage. But what happened was someone got drunk and fell into the door. that was a hurricane damage.
Well, thanks a lot, guys. Fun as always. Thank you.
All right. And David, hopefully, if I'm on again in 4 or 5 weeks, I'll have a lot more details about how VCF is shaping up.
Okay. Let me just talk to that just real quick before we sign off too is, and I hope everybody can be repeat. But as it stands, I guess we have, I'm not going to try to dig in my email, but I think we have like 12 people. Obviously, you guys are now regulars. And there were kind of like 9 people originally, three guests, and me on every show. But I tentatively have Bruce Damer lined up for the next show, and Vince Briel, and Salam be on.
Yeah, those are all great guests. And actually, Bruce just put on his Facebook page the other day, just like he said, this week was a 25th anniversary of when he moved here from Canada. Yeah, so he originally was a Canuck as well.
And I have...
And I believe Vince is in a process of moving from Cleveland out to Silicon Valley.
Exactly. I think he's moving right now, in fact. That's why he wasn't able to
hoping to work on his replicas full time. So that would be a great accomplishment if he can pull it off.
And just to mention one more person, because I have one other person joining the panel. And I'm trying to look up his last name. It's Matt. And I think it's Wilson. So I apologize, Matt. But Matt used to do a podcast some years ago called The Boring Beige Box. And top of my head, he did like 10 or so episodes. And anyway, so he's going to be on the show in February. So that's exciting. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And please check the show notes for all of the links. As it turned out, the entire greater area of Atlanta has been mostly shut down for 3 days now due to snow and ice. We received over 6 inches of snow here at my house, and I haven't been able to go to work all week. I've added a few pictures at the show notes. Don't forget about my other two podcasts, the Classic Computing Video Podcast and Stan Beats History of the Personal Computer Audiobook Podcast. I'm finishing up the 4th chapter of Stan's book, and I'm ready to start filming Video Show 3. The featured computer is the Canon Navigator. All 3 of my podcasts can be subscribed to through iTunes. Please help me out by leaving a review in the iTunes store. There's also a link on every podcast page where you can download any podcast directly. You can also help support the shows by donating through PayPal. A link is at the bottom of the show notes page. Plus, you can support the shows by using my Amazon.com links for books mentioned and with the search box. Read my blog and follow everything I'm doing at classiccomputing.com.